a special episode of Neutrality Studies. Today, we're going to do a little bit of life oral history. We have with us Professor David Gibbs, a professor of history at the University of Arizona, and we have Colonel Douglas MacGregor. The two men have in common that they both have a keen interest in what happened in the Balkans in the 1990s and early 2000s. Colonel Douglas MacGregor, because he was serving there, and Professor Gibbs, because he studies that area and that period quite closely, and they've been reacting to each other's videos on this and other channels for a couple of weeks, and now we want to bring them together. David, may I ask you to start us off maybe with where you think that this most interesting part of the Balkan Wars is that, you know, Douglas MacGregor has already reacted to you?
I just give a little bit of background, I guess, just historical background and also a little bit of background about both of us, beyond what you said, is that, you know, Yugoslavia broke up as a state in 1991, resulting in a complex series of wars and civil wars, most notably Bosnia-Herzegovina, which was settled with NATO military intervention in 1995, and then a NATO, or I should say U.S. brokered agreement. And then Kosovo in 1998-1999, also involving NATO military intervention, followed by a U.S. brokered agreement. Now, Colonel MacGregor was involved as an insider, and he, you know, we'll be discussing his experiences as a military aide to the U.S. Participants in that, in both those events. I myself have written a book on this topic in 2009, First Do No Harm, Humanitarian Intervention and the Destruction of Yugoslavia. You know, I did a podcast on this topic about a year ago. Colonel MacGregor watched the podcast, and that is what brought us together. I do want to note just, parenthetically that the importance of Yugoslavia, as far as I can tell, was to give a tremendous justification for NATO and a new raison d'etre for NATO, and also to give a whole justification for military intervention as a humanitarian act and build a whole new constituency politically in both the United States and Europe for military intervention. I would say particularly on the political left, where it became almost an idealistic act to use military force. But in any case, Colonel MacGregor obviously has a great deal of information on this going beyond what I've just presented. And let me start off by, you know, dealing with perhaps maybe the most interesting aspect, which of course is the current NATO-Russia war taking place in the arena of Ukraine. Now, when I wrote my book in 2009, one flaw in the book, and I'll be frank, I'll do some self-criticism here. I did not really deal very much with the issue of Russia. When I wrote the book, I viewed Russia, I think incorrectly, as a tangential issue owing to Russia's extraordinary weakness in the 1990s. And I thought that nobody really paid much attention to Russia on that account. In retrospect, I think that was a inadequate treatment of it. And I'd like to ask you, Colonel, what's your opinion on the role Russia played, both in terms of direct involvement, but more importantly, in the minds of U.S. officials and NATO officials, and how the Russia issue influenced U.S. and NATO conduct in Bosnia and in Kosovo?
Well, first of all, I think your book was excellent, and I think that your presentation in the podcast was first rate. I can also plead guilty to the charge that I did not appreciate at the time. And I was involved first in 1995 for several months before the Dayton Accords, and I went back for those. So I was all over Bosnia years ago, and then I got to meet lots of interesting people. And I did not appreciate at that point some of the things that you've already mentioned, the fact that this was actually a proving ground for future use of force by the United States and its so-called allies in other places, justified by these claims of humanitarian intervention and so forth. I say claims because they weren't all accurate or true. I did not appreciate how prominently Russia figured in the backs of people's minds until it was nearly over in Kosovo. And then I began to awaken to that, but I too was not completely aware, because the two are linked, but they're very different. The second round of interventions in Kosovo began on a much more fragile ground, in my estimation, than what happened with Bosnia-Herzegovina. In Bosnia, you could point to something like Srebrenica, which was not necessarily the mass murder it was billed to be, but it was significant. It was obvious. It was out there. The Dutch failed miserably to protect the people. The Dutch took off, left, abandoned the local population. Large numbers of people were then not necessarily shot. You did have rape camps where numbers of women were held until they were finally impregnated so that they would produce, I think the word was, little Chetniks. And this is nothing new in the Balkans. Mass rape is very common and is throughout history to transform populations into something they were not. And, of course, that had a lot to do with the advance of Soviet forces. It wasn't just, you know, recreation for the advancing troops. It was also purposely done to try and destroy national identity and so forth. Kosovo, though, was a little different. It was more difficult to start, let's put it that way. And when I was first approached by General Clark, whom I continue to like and think highly of personally, he said, look, I want you to go over and do this. I was going to be the director of strategy or strategic planning initially, and then move on, hopefully, to be the director of joint operations, because that was a general officer position. I was a full colonel, so that was a brigadier. Of course, I was never going to get promoted, but at that point, he was still trying. And the Brit that preceded me left, and so I was able to go through the whole process. But what begins with Kosovo is something very different from what you might imagine. When I went and I met this Air Force two-star who I would be nominally working for, he had never heard of Kosovo. And one of my first points to him was, well, is anybody looking at Kosovo? I have to understand that my background is all in European studies. Primary, people say, what did you study in graduate school? My PhD and all this kind of things. I say, Germans and Russians. That's the way to put it. Those are the two that I focused on, with a sideline and some Poles and Czechs, and to a lesser extent, some Hungarians. But, you know, you can't do business without taking in the Balkans to some extent. And I was very familiar with the Slovenes and the Croats, because they have a thousand-year relationship with the Roman Catholic Germans who live in Austria and southern Germany. Everybody out there speaks German. And so that was another reason I was picked to go, because I could speak fluent German.
Hey, just a very quick note. The best way to support this channel is by signing up for my free Substack. You can also help with a paid subscription there, or you can get some of our new merch on neutralitystudies.com. Links below. See you there.
So when this all got started, I asked, what about Kosovo? Where's Kosovo? Nobody'd heard of it. So when I'd been there for about 3 months, this was January, February, March, one of my officers, a very bright man named Cricks, he was a major in the U.S. Army. He's retired now, and he came to me as an intelligence officer. We had Canadian, British, French intelligence officers. We had German general staff. It was 19 different nations were represented in the joint operations that are all focused on the Balkans. And he came to me and said, here's this newspaper article, which had been translated from Bulgarian, which was really the language of Macedonia for all intents and purposes, had been translated into English, and I read it. It was all about a proposal by the president of Macedonia that when all of the Albanians fled Kosovo, they were going to provide a pathway for them to come into Macedonia, go around the mountain range and down into Albania, because it was made very clear we already have more Albanians than we want in Macedonia. We don't want any more. So this is a good way for them to pass down into Albania, which is, after all, where all Albanians belong. So I looked at this. I thought, this is interesting. So I cracked open the books. I started reading everything, including, believe it or not, Waffen-SS reports on the Albanians that they were sent down to train. And the SS regarded them as the worst, most horrific, atrocious people they ever met, and talked about how they had stopped the Albanians.
The SS regarded them that way?
Yeah. They saw what they were doing to gypsies and anyone who was Jewish or Turk or anything. It was just, they recommended immediate cessation of any further cooperation with the Albanians. So that got my attention. I went through an awful lot of material that went all the way up to the Yugoslav period. I found out that most of the Albanians who were in Kosovo were essentially allowed to migrate in there illegally by Tito. And their numbers kept increasing and increasing and increasing until suddenly the quote-unquote illegals outnumbered the native Serbs. Sound familiar? Anyway, bottom line is I put this short two-page paper, because anything longer than two pages, no four-star has time to read. And I wrote it up and went by the intelligence, said this is correct, and I said, we should consider contacting the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, because this is very likely to happen, and explain that if there's any major violence whatsoever, this could occur quickly. And, you know, so finished it with these recommendations and sent it up to General Clark. I didn't hear anything for 2, 3, 4 days. It turned out he flew down to Macedonia. And he looked it all over and held personal conversations with the leadership and came back. And then I got a phone call and said, come up. So I went up to his office and he said, you know, I went to Kosovo. I went to Macedonia. You're right. This is ready to happen. And I said, yes, sir, it's much more serious than people realize. What did you think about our recommendations? He said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, pre-position humanitarian assistance, set up, you know, some people there that can help with these Albanians if they come out, as we expect they probably would. He said, why would I do that? And I said, well, they're going to come out unless, you know, we can come to some sort of agreement over there. And I said, by the way, one of the recommendations was that he talk to General Perisic, who was the Serb who commanded the Yugoslav army, Vojska Yugoslavska. And he was very widely respected because he had put a stop to any sort of outrages against the Albanian citizens of Yugoslavia. He made it very clear he was going to tolerate it. Remember, we had the special police, and then you had the army. They were not the same. And the special police, of course, would occasionally go overboard and do things that they had no business doing. And I said, you really ought to talk to him because he's expressed the view that Serbia should join NATO. Think about that. Now, how did I know that? I knew that because I had been shown by British officers communiques coming from the British ambassador in Belgrade, whose name was Donnelly, who's a very confident man. And he was providing advice back to the deputy SACEUR, who was a British four-star. His name was Mackenzie, who, believe it or not, was a distant relative of mine. That's another story. We're all Scottish, so I had a certain rapport instantly. So I was able to read all this. I said, this is a great opportunity. You can go meet with Perisic. So he says, I don't want to meet with him. I said, why not? He said, I don't want to meet with the Serbs. I said, why not? He said, we're going to bomb the Serbs. Now, this is early April of 1998, and I sort of stood there a little surprised. I mean, I'm just a colonel in the army. My last experience of anything was in command at Fort Riley, and before that, I was in the desert shooting Arabs. So I had no idea that this was in anybody's mind at that point. And subsequently, I found out that General Clark had been assigned to Southcom for a year waiting for the American military commander in shape to retire. And once he retired, General Clark was put in there because the same bunch that had intervened in Bosnia-Herzegovina wanted to intervene again in Kosovo. And
why?
They were convinced, first of all, that air power had been this magical instrument with which to compel acceptance. Secondly, they all wanted to get rid of Milosevic, whom they regarded as an evil dictator, an old line communist, along with the people around him. And then ultimately Yugoslavia then could become what they had tried to do in Bosnia-Herzegovina that didn't work, was this sort of laboratory to forcibly integrate all the various groups so that they could all live in the future diversity paradise that Europe was going to have to be anyway. And, you know, when you talk to them and said, well, these people just spent the last several years killing each other. A lot of blood has been spilled at this point. I don't think forcing them back together is going to work very well. You were thanked for your interest and told to shut up and get in the corner and color. So the plan was, well, we're going to intervene. This will be the end of Milosevic. Yugoslavia will fall into our laps and we will have this laboratory for experimentation that we want. In other words, sort of exporting social engineering with military power. I was stunned. I just didn't completely grasp it for the same reasons it made
me. I just clarification here. So the idea of setting it up as a laboratory, whose idea was that specifically?
Well, I think you've got to go back to several people. The key figures in Washington were never included Bill Clinton. I think we need to understand that President Clinton was just not interested.
Yeah.
He was never interested in anything beyond America's borders. Unfortunately, he was surrounded by people like Gore and Albright. I think Warren Christopher was lukewarm. But then you had Sandy Berger and Strobe Talbot, the Deputy Secretary of Defense. And, of course, General Clark was friends with all of these people. And they were all of a similar ideological mindset, that this was the beginning of something very big. And what I was going to tell you is that in December of 1998, it was made clear to me that this was the beginning of a revolution, what they call the democratic revolution, that's going to spread from Yugoslavia all the way to Moscow. And that was the first time that I heard openly the statement, this was the beginning of something that would go all the way to Moscow. And I was stunned because, again, you know, I did know a little bit about the history of the region, and my immediate response when I was in the War Plans Division in 1995 as a war planner, I was asked to write a position paper on what should we do or not do in the Balkans. I said, we should stay out. I said, this is an area of traditional Russian influence. And if we were to involve ourselves there, it would be viewed as potentially threatening to Russian interests. And I talked about the special relationship between the Serbs and others and the Russians, reaching all the way back to 1879 and earlier. Of course, you know, the chief of staff loved it. He sent it over to the White House. It died. That was 1995. There was never...
Shelly Kashvili? Are you referring to Shelly Kashvili?
The chief of staff of the army was Gordon Sullivan.
Yes, sir.
And he said, yeah, this makes sense. Everybody on the army side, because the last thing we want to do is go over there. Now, one thing I need to point out, there was one person in the Clinton administration who absolutely did not sign on for all of this. That was Secretary Perry, the Secretary of Defense.
Hmm.
And at one point, he said to General Clark, he was giving guidance on what we should or shouldn't do with the Dayton Accords if they happened. And he said, remember, no agreement is better than a bad agreement. That was the first thing. So if we can't get agreement, that's all right. Secondly, we don't want any Danzig corridors. In other words, we don't want any unstable, unmaintainable territorial outcomes that are going to invite future violence and so forth. And then finally, he said, we don't want any agreement that involves a commitment of U.S. ground forces on the ground in the Balkans. Well, what did we get? Well, we got all that we didn't want. We got this long strip of land out to Srebrenica. It's made no sense. And in the meantime, the Serbs continued to be demonized violently, blamed for everything. And then when I was still not yet the director of the Joint Operations Center, I was the director of strategic planning, I was required to send a report, because remember, we had this agreement with the OSCE that they would go in and monitor what both sides were doing. And by the way, I thought the OSCE did a brilliant job. Let there be no mistake about it. And I made a habit of listening to all the German officers who would come and see me. They were coming out of Kosovo to tell me what was happening. General Rupert Smith, who had then replaced McKenzie, who was a brilliant officer, did a brilliant job. He actually met with all the journalists, which shocked everyone, because he said, well, the journalists are down there. They're visiting. They can tell me what's really happening. And they did. So we had a lot of very, very good information coming in. And one of the things that I discovered was that if you had 10 incidents of some sort of provocation that violated the agreements under the OSCE, 9 were committed by the KLA. Only 1 was committed by the Serbs. And the Serbs actually went out of their way to enforce things, to make it work right. Long story. And I sent these reports up, and I was called in. I said, look, we need to demonstrate the disproportionate use of force by the Serbs. If we can't prove disproportionate use of force by the Serbs, it's going to be that much harder for us to justify military action. And I said, I can't find it.
General Klaus.
It was taken away from me. And by that time, we had Alistair Campbell's group that had sent some people over at the request, I guess, of General Clark to Tony Blair. I need some help. And they came in, and I never saw any more reports going to Brussels because I was told, no, we'll take care of it up here. But I couldn't find any. And again, I was naive. I was not part of the cabal trying to bring on operations. Let's put it that way.
General Klaus von Naumann, who was somebody I assume you interacted with there, he also said repeatedly, no, you didn't know. All right, he said repeatedly that the Serbs actually honored a ceasefire agreement in 1998 and that it was much more the KLA, the Kosovo Liberation Army, the Albanian side, that caused the breakdown of that ceasefire, just consistent with what you're saying here.
When I reported to three four-stars as the director of the Joint Operations Center. All three had to agree to my appointment. So one obviously was General Clark. The other was General Rupert Smith, Deputy Supreme Commander Europe. And the other was a German four-star. His name was Strickmann. I thought he was probably one of the finest officers I've ever met and a man of absolute integrity who was deeply troubled by all of it. And the night that we bombed Belgrade, he was practically in tears. He thought this was a disgrace because it was the anniversary of the German air attack.
Right, of course. Right.
He said, we all became NATO members to prevent anything like this from ever happening again. Everyone had the view on the European side that NATO existed to ensure there would be no future wars in Europe. And now here he was, part of an alliance that was deliberately starting one.
Well, my read on that was that NATO needed a new justification after the Cold War. And a bombing campaign in Kosovo for, quote-unquote, humanitarian purposes served that purpose. I mean, what you're telling me, though, is that a lot of the senior officers did not share that view. Am I hearing you correctly?
Yes.
One of the things, I guess, is that the Russians, from the Russian standpoint, we know Yeltsin, who was then in power, not doing very well, obviously, but nevertheless in power officially, he viewed this as kind of a shot across the bow to Russia that was seen in threatening terms to Russia. That's how he viewed it, more or less publicly, I think, if I'm correct on that. And I'm wondering to what extent American officials did that intentionally, or was this just something they didn't really care about? In other words, if Russia saw this as threatening, was that something American officials were worried about, or did they just disregard it?
Russia was viewed at the time as a basket case.
Yeah.
Remember, it was being looted by people like Brouwer and others who came over, as Joseph Stiglitz warned against it and said, whatever you do, you don't want to put Russia through this cold turkey. You know, they've got to move from their current economic system slowly in the direction of something that's more market-oriented and effective. Well, Clinton had no interest in it, turned it over to others, and the others went in there, made a terrible mess. At one point, I was told that Yeltsin sent a representative to Shape asking if we could assist them in recovering $4 billion that had been looted from Russia and was probably residing in various banks, not the least of which were in Cyprus or elsewhere. So I think people sort of viewed Russia as incapable, a basket case, and was prostrate. Therefore, you can do pretty much what you want. This is back to the whole idea of the phony rules-based liberal international order, which simply means now we can extend the Cold War structure and become the hegemon of the planet because no one is there to stop us. I mean, that was my perception, ultimately.
One question I had is that the air war went on, I believe, for something like 78 days, yeah. And at first, it was, they're expecting a rapid capitulation, which did not occur, and it seemed to go on and on. The Serbs did make an effective defense, at least for a while. And
we never degraded the Serbian air defenses below 83%.
I see. Okay, that's good to know. There was frustration, obviously, in military circles and in Washington, and I don't remember the exact month, but Thomas Friedman had an article in the New York Times, which is very interesting, called Stop the Music, in which he said what the United States needs to do is begin to bomb Serbia back to the Middle Ages. He said we can bring them back to 1389 if that's what they want. It was kind of a blood-curdling article. And what I wondered when I read the article is, was he speaking? He had a lot of official contacts. We know that about Friedman. When he wrote this article, was he just speaking for himself, or was he channeling something he'd heard in the White House or the State Department? What are your thoughts on that? In other words, was the State Department or the Clinton administration acting through Friedman to make a threat to Serbia that you better capitulate, or we'll just level your cities? What are your thoughts on that, Colonel?
First of all, I can't prove that anybody in the administration put him up to that.
All right.
What I can say is that you've got to go back and understand that Wolfowitz and Pearl and Kagan and others, I mean, Don Kagan wrote the foreword to my second book, and I thought very highly of Don Kagan. And, you know, I found out later why he liked my book so much, which kind of upset me later on. But he came and visited Clark with a group of people, and these were all the original neocons, who have now reproduced and spawned new generations that are with us. They brought us into Iraq and everything else. It all flows. Let us say that if water is purest at its source, we were at the fountainhead back in the 90s of all of these people who are still running the show right now. In fact, if you scratch hard enough, you'll go down low enough, you'll find Tony Blinken running around, I guess, on the NSC staff or in the State Department, some lower level. So you got to understand, they're all in the same boat. They're all acolytes of the same thing. Don Kagan came down to visit me in the Joint Operations Center, and he started talking about the terrible things that had been done by the Serbs, and don't we need to go and do this? And I sort of sat there, and I said, what are you talking about? And he reiterated, and he said, so we really need to do this, don't we? And I sort of sat there, what am I supposed to say? No. So I said, well, that's, you know, very interesting. Nice to see you again. Thank you. And I think, you know, you got to go to Vice President Gore, Sandy Berger, Madeleine Albright, Strobe Talbot, Warren Christopher. All of these people are in the same group. And they're all believers in the ideology that you so brilliantly outlined in your podcast. And it all goes back to Bosnia and the perception of success in Bosnia. Based on air power.
Did you see any direct role of people like Wolfowitz and Pearl in this, or were they completely just on the sidelines?
When I was at Dayton, I opened the door and I was surprised to see Richard Pearl walking down the hall, whom I knew. And I said, hello, how are you? What are you doing? So I'm looking for the Bosniaks. Hmm. So they were already in bed with the quote unquote Bosniaks. That was their new laboratory, what I would call lab rat. And I think you were talking at some point about, you know, sort of projecting onto various things, Holocaust-like experiences. And that was definitely done with the Bosniaks. Now, suddenly, the Bosniaks were transformed from being enthusiastic National Socialists into the victims of racism and so forth.
Yes, that was done very, very carefully.
Yeah. At some point, right?
I'm sorry, say again, please.
Everybody's a victim at some point.
So. Well, it seems to be the new thing is to be a victim. But one other person, I guess, that's of interest to me, of course, is Brzezinski. Now, Brzezinski was not officially in the chain of command in any sense of the term, but he was certainly a figure on the sidelines. I just was in his papers in the Library of Congress. And throughout the 90s, he was still in the private sector, advocating much closer U.S. involvement in Ukraine already. And I'm wondering, did he play any role that you saw as an unofficial advisor with regard to Bosnia or Kosovo? Did you see any role by him here?
Not that I'm aware of. That doesn't mean there weren't phone calls made and he wasn't given the opportunity to express his views, because I know that he told Clinton in private that Ukraine was a potential catalyst for future war. And he was right. And he said Eastern Ukraine is effectively Russified. And he actually suggested that some attempt be made through a plebiscite or something else to come to terms with that reality so that you didn't get a war down the line, which I frankly said in 2014 when they had their little coup, and I made the mistake of going on RT, for which I was harassed by the Senate when I was considered for the ambassador's job in Berlin. But no, I think he said that, and he was, I think, absolutely right. Now, when I came back from Bosnia, I had lunch with someone who was an old friend and a mentor to me, and that was Bill Odom. And I had lunch with him at the Army-Navy Club, and he was very much an advocate for the sort of human rights crusade that could animate military action against everybody. I was not. I never signed on for any of that. I mean, I'm strictly a realist. I would tell you that I'm an isolationist, frankly. My view is, unless they attack us, why are we attacking them? But he was very much involved with that, and we had an argument. And he said, I think we should put 3 divisions on the ground in the Balkans and let them stay there until they all change. Well, things don't change very quickly in the Balkans, or in most countries, it's been my experience. And the last thing I thought we should do is make that kind of commitment. So after that, we spoke once, and I saw him about 3 weeks before he died, unfortunately. And we were on speaking terms, but the warmth and friendship was gone because I did not support it. So he was a Brzezinski acolyte. So I think that gives you an indication of where he stood. And I found when I came back, I had all sorts of people coming, great job in the Joint Operations Center. We're so proud of what you did. I was saying, you know, well, I thought it was a disaster. I didn't think we had any business doing any of it.
In fact, explain a little bit more. Why do you think it was a disaster? I'll flesh that out a little bit.
Well, first of all, I don't think we settled anything in Bosnia because we had to leave troops there. There are still European troops there. And then the Europeans poured large quantities of money into the place. And if anybody thinks that all the wounds are healed and all is great, all they have to do is visit Srpska. And I could never understand why people objected to simply turning over the territory occupied by Serbs to Serbia. What is the problem? If they all want to live together, by God, let them do it. And I remember getting in an argument with a Norwegian, and he was saying, well, they have to learn to live together and on. I said, well, I think we should just abolish the border between Sweden and Norway. Why do we need these silly flags? You all speak the same language. Oh, man, that's different. Yeah, okay, fine. Thanks very much. This kind of hypocrisy and stupidity was widespread. The further away you got, from the Balkans, the dumber people were. In the people closest to the Balkans, the Italians, for instance, or the people, the Austrians, the Greeks, the Bulgars, they knew the fact. They understood what was happening. Even Tuđman, you know, he had his famous napkin solution. I'm sure you're familiar with that. That wasn't a bad solution. You were talking about Rambouillet. During Rambouillet, the Serbs and the Albanians were in separate rooms, but they both agreed to the same partition.
And Rambouillet, let me ask you, the way I saw the situation was that you almost had an agreement. The Serbs had pretty much agreed to all the political terms, or almost all of them, not quite. And then the military annex appeared, which involved basically the right of NATO peacekeepers to occupy not just Kosovo, but Serbia proper, the Republic of Serbia. And this whole thing broke down. The Serbs did not accept that. They would not even consider it. I'm told that this was inserted by Wesley Clark, and a British defense ministry official said it was done with the intention of blowing up the peace talks and laying the basis for a bombing campaign. He said that in a parliamentary hearing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, General Clark undoubtedly saw it. He may have made some recommendation for revisions. I don't know who authored it. I certainly didn't.
Okay.
But that was, remember, those things were taken away from me, so I wasn't monitoring those things anymore. But I know from the Norwegian one star who was present, his name was Lundbeck, and he was a very sharp man and a wonderful man. And he was brought over there as an observer because Shape and Brussels said, we want someone there as an observer. General Clark obviously was not allowed to observe directly and participate. Well, Lundberg was somebody who agreed with me 100%. What are we doing? This is disastrous. But he came and told me that the Serbs and the Albanians reached the agreement to partition the place. The Serbs would get Mitrovica and the stretch along the border. The Albanians would get the rest of it. the Germans in private had said they would help finance the movement of populations. That had happened under Kohl. Now, I don't know if that still existed by under his successor. But people had seen, you know, look, if we can't all live in Brčko, let's build a second Brčko in Bosnia. Yeah, we'll finance it. All of those things were crushed by the American side. And even the French foreign minister was surprised. And I think Christopher Hill played a key role in that. And you might ask him if he'll tell you. But as my impression was that he made it very clear we wouldn't accept that. And then, of course, General Clark at one point actually flew over there in his UH-60 to talk to the KLA. They came out to meet with him. What passed between them, I don't know. But I know that his view was, look, we'll bomb for you. He said that at Dayton to the Bosniaks, to Sacher Bey and company. I'm sure he said something similar. The idea was they wanted to bring on the administration, not Clinton, but practically everybody else, with the exception of Perry in the first time around. The second time around, I think Cullen went along with these things, wasn't really excited about it. You know, it just was not some sort of forceful advocate for it at all. But he wasn't going to stand in the way. But he did intervene ultimately during the campaign and say, I told General Clark, you can use whatever you like, but you cannot have any ground forces. There will be no ground forces involved in this. Mm. And that, of course, is one of the reasons that within 2 or 3 weeks of the end, Strobe Talbot, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, State, goes to Moscow to negotiate an end to this. And I think he went there, and I think a number of promises were made to Yeltsin. And at that point, the Russians needed help and assistance in a number of key areas. I don't know that those promises were ever honored. I have no idea. But suddenly the air campaign ended because the Russians informed Milosevic, we can't support you. And see, the promise for Milosevic, we knew this from inside the Serbian general staff, was that whatever happened, we will provide you with the food and the sustenance and the fuel to get through the Balkan winter. And so they were prepared to fight until hell froze over, literally. Well, they weren't going to get any support anymore from the Russians, and we had destroyed the power grid, all the coal plants that fired up heating and electricity and everything else, so that nothing was coming from Russia.
I see. Well, you know, since you're a German speaker, I'm wondering, did you have much dealings with Joschka Fischer? My recollection is he was, oh, you did not. I see. All right.
My interaction was entirely with members of the military.
I see.
I met with many officers, German officers, some of whom were generals, but the one that was most important, obviously, in my life was Strickmann, the German four-star at Schade. And both he and Rupert Smith together were very, very competent, very, I would say, balanced in their assessments, and both privately didn't want intervention there.
There was an incident at the very end of the Kosovo War when the quote-unquote peacekeepers were inserted, and there was a rush by to get to the Pristina airport, as I recall. And Clark basically insisted that the British commander, I think it was Rupert, General Rupert.
No, it wasn't Smith. It was the commander down in of the Kosovo force, who was a three-star, who there, later became chief of staff of the British Army. His name escapes me at the moment, but he's a good man. But he was appointed down there for all the right reasons. He was very competent, good soldier, had good relations with all the composite units that were under his command. And he received some orders from Clark, which were very confrontational vis-a-vis the Russians. Clark wanted to push them off the airfield.
Why? That was an interesting detail. And so what do you make of that incident where there was an effort basically to make sure the Russians did not get a control of the airfield? And again, Russia then was supposedly on good terms with the United States and Britain and NATO. And here there seemed to be this adversarial aspect. One of the British generals, I believe, if I recall correctly, refused to take the aggressive action that was requested by Clark. He said, I don't want to start World War III. Do I remember that correctly?
Oh, that was the Kosovo commander. The three-star was in command down there. And he also had a pretty good working knowledge of Russian. I guess he'd been to Oxford for a while or Cambridge, I don't know which. At any rate, he went over to personally meet with the Russian commander. And they had an amicable discussion, and they came to a resolution. And the Russians maintained part of the airfield, but they didn't, you know, have control of all of it. And we had no further difficulties with the Russians. In fact, after that, I would say cooperation with the Russians was very good. When they put forces on the ground, they cooperated with our troops and with everybody else without any difficulty at all. You're asking why was Clark so confrontational? I don't know. He never discussed it with me. Okay. But that was the undercurrent. You see, when I told you about December of 1998, when this came up about we're going to sweep all the way to Russia, there was always this undercurrent on the American side that was there was hostility there to Russia. Russia was not democratic. Russia was all these bad things.
That's a very strange thing because, I mean, Clinton had praised Yeltsin and the White House, I believe, 96, during, you know, and basically, what did he compare him to? George Washington or something like that. And he praised him as a Democrat and that he was a democratic figure and so on. It was a democratic transition. He was a great hope for Russia. So why now was there talk of spreading democracy to Moscow and supposedly Yeltsin represented democracy, at least for public purposes, in terms of what the Americans were projecting? Why this sense that we now have to evangelize the Russians and make them democratic all of a sudden? What was that about?
I think the people that we've mentioned by name were all part of that movement. And the anti-Russian position or mentality, the hostility, which you can still see today, which is very prevalent, these sort of neocon circles that are now almost indistinguishable, in my view, from the so-called Zionist lobby. Mm-hmm. They're all the same, and they're all very hostile to Russia. Now, some people, and this may be true, I don't know, but some people argue, well, these people like Madeleine Albright and others have relatives or whatever who were driven out of Russia. Okay, that's fine. I don't know, but it's very strong. It's very much there, and it was there in 1998, and it was in evidence afterwards. It's unfortunate. Now, Yeltsin, if you go and ask the Russians about Yeltsin, they see him as a drunken buffoon who was a patsy that let the Americans and the West walk all over him. Putin comes in, and he's an heroic figure because he throws all the crooks out and all the oligarchs out, or has them executed, who were trying to loot Russia and steal from Russia. So for whatever it's worth, that's the sort of official, I don't want to say official, but the common Russian view of Yeltsin and where Putin fits in.
One other angle to my book that I took was that a key issue here was that Europe was briefly considering an independent foreign policy. This was an initiative led by initially France and then France and Germany. And the idea was to use the European Community, as it was called then, as an instrument, almost as an alternative to NATO. The United States had gained too much power after the end of the Cold War, and this was to establish a new pole of independence in the world. The United States saw this in very threatening terms, and again, a neocon project was to undermine this independence and to reassert NATO as an alternative to this independence. And the arena was to be the Balkans, because the Europeans were trying to broker a peace agreement of their own to demonstrate their capacity to act independently, whereas the U.S., I argued, undermined the peace agreements to humiliate Europe and demonstrate that only the U.S. and NATO would have authority in these areas. What did you think of that interpretation? I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, at that point, I was a promotable lieutenant colonel in Sarajevo, and it became pretty clear that Holbrooke's view was that the Europeans, or referred to as the Euros, were useless and incompetent, and they should all be shoved on a plane and flown away. So when you get to Dayton, there's very little European representation. I remember sitting there talking to a British officer. He had a little Euro flag, you know, EU flag. Okay, they were irrelevant, and it was made very clear to me that they were irrelevant, and they just didn't have a vote. Don't pay any attention to them. And nothing would happen if it were not for us. We were in charge. Now, there's something else here that comes up later on. The Europeans tried to build something called the Eurocorps, and they built a core headquarters. Mm-hmm. And that was a real bone of contention for a lot of people.
Yeah, I remember the.
And and anything that competed with NATO was unpopular. Now, when the whole thing was over, just as an aside for the German four star, and I sat down and talked to you, because I was basically, you know, in my last 2 months, I didn't have to do anything, thank God. I was pretty worn out. And he said, what would you like to do? And I talked to him, and then I said, what would you like me to do? He said, well, I want you to do what you want to do, but I want to give it a different twist. And so I spent the next 2 months putting together this packet on how the Europeans should build their own command and control structure and headquarters. Because I said the lesson from Kosovo, in my judgment, is you have no command and control background. There is no European C4ISR. Command, control, communications, computers, intelligence, defense, reconnaissance. Everything is dependent upon us. And he agreed. So I put that together. And I said, what do you think? And he said, I think it's good work, but I don't think it's going to go anywhere. And it was pretty clear that the United States didn't want it to go anywhere. They wanted the Europeans to be dependent upon us. And we wanted them to behave as vassals. So it was kind of interesting to me when I listened to Donald Trump complained about NATO yesterday and then criticized the South Koreans. And I'd spent time in South Korea. I did some work for their Ministry of Defense for the same reason, saying, you know, you need to build your own capability. And then when it was over, this is back in 2010, I said, what are you going to do with it? They said, we're putting it on the shelf. And I said, what are you going to do with it then? And he said, well, when the Americans leave, we'll implement most of what you've said. So we are in the business of keeping everyone dependent upon this massive global command, control, communications complex with all of the satellite arrays and everything else. And if you don't have that, you can't be independent.
When the war... Okay, yeah, sorry. Go ahead, Pascal.
Sorry, I have one thing, which is that there is a very interesting German language documentary, and the title is "It Started with a Lie." It's begun mit einer Lüge, and that's all about the main political case that was made in order to start the bombing of Serbia, which is that apparently or allegedly, which was ultimately like all fabricated, was the Serbs executing massive numbers of civilians on a football field somewhere in Pristina. And, you know, that was used, as a parallel to what, you know, what happened in Bosnia with Srebrenica. And that's why Srebrenica was so important, in order to reinvoke this kind of guilt that we didn't intervene then. The Dutch failed, the UN corps failed. So now we need to do something. And this time it's going to be the moment for NATO to shine. And even the Germans signed off on it. And actually, it turns out the German foreign minister at the time was then very proud that they managed to convince the Germans to actually go along and finally overcome this hesitation of, you know, the bad memories of years, decades past, right? What do you make out of that? Were you involved in this as well?
Well, when you say involved, there was a lot of action that I was in the middle of. You know, necessarily involved with everything, but I was able to witness a lot. It was very clear that the MUP, which was the abbreviation for the special police that the Serbs had in Kosovo, was accused of doing a lot of things. How much of it they did and how much of they didn't, I don't know. I have some material left over. A friend of mine who was a U.S. Army colonel, intelligence officer. He was working with me. And he had photographs, satellite imagery that had been taken of fires that were supposedly set. And his point to me was, if you look at where these are, every house that was hit was KLA. In other words, if they went into a village of Albanians, they went directly to the house that had the KLA people in it. Nobody else in the village was harmed in any way. No one else was hurt. But these kinds of photographs were used. See, they're burning villages. See, they're murdering people. Yeah, arbitrarily or deliberately. So, yeah, that argument was made. Now, what about the Germans? I think Joschka Fischer was probably making virtue out of necessity. Because the Germans were treated at the time as shut up. You know what you did in the past. You have to be part of this. I don't think the Germans had a whole hell of a lot of choice at that point. If I were a German at that point, I would have bailed out of NATO. I'd have said, the hell with you. But the Germans weren't prepared for that. And I asked subsequently, I said, when do you think the Germans are finally going to wake up? And the consensus among the German officers was another 20 years if we're lucky. So I think the Germans were sort of pushed along in the stream of things. That's one thing. Now, this is very important. We sent up a lot of material to senior headquarters, to General Clark and to Brussels, made it very clear. If you bomb, you're going to get the mass exodus of Albanians out of Kosovo. Well, of course you are. Why would you leave every other Albanian with a cell phone on the ground in Kosovo to call in your location so that you could be murdered from the air? So we got to get all these agents of the enemy out of the country. So at that point, there was no longer any discrimination between those Albanians that were legitimate citizens of Yugoslavia and the Kosovar Albanians, in other words, the KLA, no more distinction. Everybody out. You got 5 minutes, 10 minutes, gather your stuff, you're out of here. So they would start, they drove them exactly where the Macedonian president said they would go. They came over the border exactly where he said they would come. Well, then CNN was cooperating by interviewing these Albanians. What happened? Oh, my daughter was raped. My son was killed. My son was taken by the Serbs. Well, what we found out was that the Serbs weren't doing any of those things. But when they got close to the border, the KLA walked up and said, you're a young man. You're 19. You're in the KLA now. Pull him out. They'd look at the girl and say, how old are you? You're going to the brothel. You're out. What have you got on you? You've got jewelry? Oh, we're taking it. And then they were said, when you go through, you tell everybody the Serbs did this to you or we'll kill you. Christian Amanpour didn't report that.
Hashim Thaçi, of course, was a KLA leader. And we all know what happened to Hashim Thaçi. Of course, he's been essentially a criminal. I believe, if not mistaken, he was convicted of crimes. Do I have that right? And
I know I've lost track at this point.
That's recalled from memory, but he certainly is not a nice man. Let's put it that way. How much of Thatcher's background was known to NATO at this time?
As far as I can tell, everybody. Everybody had knowledge. I mean, the joke in the hallways was, have all those boxes of Knickerbockers and white wigs and tricorn caps arrived so that all these future democratic revolutionaries have the right dress, because, you know, people were comparing them to America's revolutionaries. Yeah, and I sort of listened to this and my stomach was bilious. I was nauseated. But this was part of the bigger myth. These are just like we were in 1780, fighting for our freedom. Okay, fine. Thanks. It's all nonsense, but it didn't matter. And that's why I really appreciated that film, Wag the Dog. If you saw Wag the Dog, that's a perfect demonstration of what really happened. Most of it was nonsense, and it worked. Have you seen that, Professor?
I show it to my students, actually.
It's a
film. It is funny, yes. But it's also, there's parts of it that do ring true. Let's put it that way.
Much true.
But I was going to ask you one thing you did have in Germany was a remarkable change in attitude with regard to warfare, including warfare outside of Germany. And it seemed to me Joschka Fischer was instrumental in arguing for this, that he really changed completely the German political left from being anti-interventionist, especially the Green Party, remarkable change, the Green Party, from being anti-interventionist to being one of the most pro-war parties in Europe. And Annalena Baerbock, you might say, is an intellectual descendant of him. And so he did play a key role as far as I can tell. I mean, do you think this was all just he was bullied by the Americans, or did he actually, was there something in it for him? It seemed there was a certain enthusiasm there that seemed to be authentic.
A friend of mine in Germany told me many years later, he said, Douglas, do you realize that the Germans have finally abandoned any thinking of racial superiority? He said, now they are all morally superior to the rest of us. He said, I don't know which is worse. I'm sick of them. And he's a German. So I think for a lot of Germans on the left, this became a justification for demonstrating their moral rectitude, turpitude, whatever, and superiority to others. Now, where are things today? I don't think they're there anymore. I think Baerbock's position is not very popular in Germany at all.
What do you think? I'm sorry. Do you want to say something, Pascal?
I just wanted to ask whether we could use the last 5 to 10 minutes that we have left to kind of bring it to this Russian angle that we had in the beginning. Is like this experimenting ground of how to then use this and go further east. I don't exactly know where the question here is, but maybe you have thoughts on that.
Well, I think the professor was correct. I didn't appreciate it at the time. It just didn't leap out at me. Let's put it that way. But very definitely, the whole Serbian intervention was a dress rehearsal for what would later be tried against the Russians. And I think there was a tendency, just as people underestimated the Serbs. I mean, I know that when Bill Clinton asked the little group of advisors, how long will this last? He was told 2 or 3 days, 10 days, 2 weeks at the most. And I was presented with that and asked, what do I think? I said, well, sir, this could last 6 days, 6 months, 6 years. I said, you're talking about the Serbs. I mean, you never know with the Serbs. The Germans killed 600,000 of them. I said, it doesn't strike me that this is going to be a pushover. And of course, you know, I was told, you're wrong. The Serbs never unified. They always fight amongst each other. Well, they did. But on this particular occasion, I think the Serbs hung together very well. And the funny thing was that when Milosevic announced the Russians are pulling out on us, his general stood around him and said, well, what did you expect? We told you you couldn't depend on the Russians for this. This is not the same. This is not 1914. So the Russian dimension was there for reasons that I can't entirely explain that don't strike me as being very rational. But then a lot of this is emotional. And the American people aren't really involved. I mean, General Clark asked me in October of 98, I had gone home for a week. My family was at the time residing in Colorado Springs. I hadn't seen anybody for months. So I went there because I knew things were coming in the spring of 99. And when I came back, he said, well, what are the folks in Colorado Springs think? I said, sir, most of them think that Kosovo is a town in Missouri hit by a tornado. And my point was nobody knew, nobody cared. Today, very few people know what's happening in the Persian Gulf, and they don't care. I hate to be blunt. It's the way it is.
But I have one more thing, which is, if I remember it correctly, if I remember the years correctly, then Jack Matlock, last U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union, was saying that he testified in front of Congress in 1996 or 1995 that the eastward expansion of NATO would be a big mistake. There was that debate going on within the U.S., and it was the Matlocks and the this crowd that lost out. But it seemed, is it far-fetched to say that 1998 rolled around and came as this convenient case to kind of build up toward making the case that no, NATO, again, out of business or out of area or out of business, and, you know, eastward expansion, good idea, necessary. Let's cement that in the ground and let's just have an example here. Is that a fair?
Well, I think Professor should say something, but one thing to keep in mind, that was Senator Richard Lugar who made that comment of NATO is either out of area or out of business. And you have to understand that there was huge backing for that from the arms industry, the military industrial complex. How do you justify what you're trying to do? And then you have the force structure issue. You know, if it promises more force structure, let's do it. This kind of nonsense has continued right up into the present until they finally ran into somebody that couldn't defeat, called Iran.
I think that one of the things I saw from this event of the defeat of the Serbs, first in Bosnia and then in Kosovo, was to give a tremendous hubris, not just to the United States, but to NATO. And the idea that NATO became such a prestigious instrument now that I think this laid the political groundwork for Eastern expansion. The fact that basically they had this sensational success, the first real serious combat activity by NATO. They never really did any actual combat in the Cold War, but now they did actual combat and proved their worth, in quotes, all in quotes. And so this basically became the justification for eastward expansion. And then conflict with Russia. I should add, just rhetorically, it's remarkable how similar the two are. the language of anti-Serb language and the anti-Russian language are really very similar in a lot of ways. The religious conviction, basically, that we're in the right and they're in the wrong, and the need to suppress all dissent through demonization, and so on. All of these things, basically, I think that the Balkans were proving ground, basically, for what later became the conflict with Russia. That's how it looks to me, anyway.
No, I think you're right. And again, I did not fully grasp that at all. And that's why I was so impressed with your interview, because in retrospect, I don't see how you could argue otherwise. I would consider the following, though. First of all, remember, the Serbs' air defenses were never degraded below 83%. We said that we didn't lose any aircraft. Large numbers of aircraft were so severely shot up and damaged that when the pilots flew it back out over the Adriatic, they reported engine failure and bailed out. In other words, the engines had been, you know, badly damaged. I saw photographs of an A-10 that looked like Swiss cheese. It was lucky to get out and made an emergency landing. There was an emergency landing made by another stealth aircraft. And that's because the Serbs did put together interesting radar arrays consisting of commercial and old Soviet radar stocks. They did track and find our stealth aircraft. And of course, pieces of that aircraft they shot down were instantly provided to the Russians and the Chinese. And of course, the Chinese were only too anxious to have that, given that we had bombed their embassy in Belgrade, sadly, unnecessarily. But that had to do with the fact that you started out with, I think, something in the neighborhood of 125 valid military targets. After that, there were no other valid military targets in Yugoslavia. Now, why not? Well, Yugoslavia was hardly the mainstream European country. It was backward. It hadn't developed very much. Well, then you have to sit down and start justifying the expansion of your target array to other places that have nothing to do with the military. We've done that in Iran. Because ultimately, the bombing answer, the Air Force answer is, well, keep bombing and bombing more and more things. And of course, the things they like to hit most of all are the things that don't move. It's called infrastructure. We should have admitted the truth. At the end of the war, the air war, I went down to Kosovo and checked in with the British commander, who was very good to me. And he said, here, take this Range Rover, go see all the battle damage. And I said, how long will it take me? He said, 20 minutes, maybe 30 minutes. And what I found out was that out of the claims that were made, we destroyed 11 tanks, 12 to 14 self-propelled guns, another 60, 70 different kinds of wheeled vehicles. You know, these BDR, BDRMs, BMPs, things like that. So when the words were, they were going to announce the numbers, which were grossly inflated, were nowhere connected to reality. And the funny thing was, there was an Air Force colonel there from the U.S. Air Force doing the same thing I was doing. His name was McDonald. We both met and we both said, yep, there's not much to report. Well, then suddenly we report we destroyed hundreds of tanks and thousands of vehicles and so forth. Killed a very, very few soldiers, by the way. The Serbs proved very, very expert at dispersing. And to be fair, the Air Force generals, before this began, warned us that once the Serbian military deployed to the field, they would be very hard to find and hit. So they wanted to hit them in their cantonment areas, in the barracks, before they got anywhere. Incidentally, the same argument was made to Putin by the Russians. Said, let's hit them. Hit the Ukrainians while they're in their barracks. Don't let them disperse or deploy. Putin wouldn't do it because he still believed at that point, these are Orthodox Slavs like us. We don't want to kill them. Took him a while to get over that. My point is, we were wrong. We were right not to hit them in the barracks. That would have been a disaster. But it was difficult for General Clark to get the Secretary General on board. Secretary General at the time was a Spaniard, and he was very uncomfortable with the whole thing, but he finally signed off on it. But my point is that after it was over, we didn't do the damage we claimed. And in fact, the British commander of KFOR received a telegram, which he showed me. He said, look at this. And it was from the Ministry of Defense. It said, whatever numbers are announced today by SHAPE headquarters, you will support them without question. Please acknowledge. because he knew it was crap. My argument at the time was we should be truthful and show what air power cannot do, because we didn't have any ground forces. Unless you put a force on the ground, your enemy's not going to mass against you. It doesn't have to, and it'll survive. But nobody wanted to do that. So the myth of air power that starts in Desert Storm, by the way, just gets worse after Bosnia, is out of control after Kosovo. And then you knock over non-entities like the Afghans, who have no air or missile defense. You knock over this Iraqis who've been reduced to abject poverty and have nothing. Then you make the false assumption that, well, we're the toughest, we're the best, nobody can stand against us, we're invulnerable, we're invincible. Attack Iran. Big mistake.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for all of these very, very interesting explanations and reviews. Maybe just to wrap it up, David, is there one more thing that's on your mind that you would like to ask to finish it?
Overall, Colonel, I suppose that when you look back on this, do you see that the American victories in Bosnia and then in Kosovo, would be fair to say that this, in retrospect, has been something of a disaster, both for the Balkans and also in setting a precedent and, shall we say, a pathway to eventual conflict with Russia? I mean, that's how I would see it. Do you see it that way as well, or do you see it differently?
No, in fact, I subscribe to your view. First, do no harm. Interventions distort regional dynamics. You create false economies. Where there was no corruption, there is shortly after the U.S. Army arrives, I can tell you that, because we always arrive with vast quantities of things that people want that can be smuggled in, turned into a black market, and make lots of money. In other words, if you don't have to go, don't go. And that's impossible right now, given the attitudes inside the United States at the highest levels. If you sat down with the average American, black or white, doesn't matter, and you said, well, listen, I don't think we should go, and this is why I don't think we should go. These people haven't attacked us. We don't have a real interest in this. We wish them all well. We'll certainly send humanitarian aid and assistance. And when it ends, if we can help, we'll certainly do it. But we should not directly intervene militarily. I think most Americans would say, of course not. Mm. But they were never consulted. Mm. No one is ever consulted. And a small group of people, if you're a well-organized minority, you got a lot of money, you could do a lot in Washington. And I think everybody's learned that, whether you're in the pharmaceutical industry or you're in any other industry, the arms industry, doesn't matter. We're a big country and most people are not involved.
And this is where I'm going to make a little cap that will say, make America neutral again. That's the spirit of neutrality. We will send you a humanitarian aid, but we won't get involved. It's not rocket science. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time today. Colonel Douglas MacGregor, Professor David Gibbs, and we will talk in the future again. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.